our next guest, whose book puts Dunedin's history front and centre. It's a novel about a young woman called Greer, raised in an area of the city known in the late 19th century as the Devil's Half Acre. Greer goes off to work as a maid at Lanark Castle after the death of her father, and for a time her story is linked to that of the castle's owner, William Lanark, and his family. Karen McMillan spent time researching her book, Turbulent Threads, as part of her residency at the Robert Lord Writer's Cottage, and the story is stocked with real events, places and people from the city's past. Karen is in the Wellington studio. Kia ora, good morning. Welcome.
Yeah, good morning. It's lovely to be in studio with you.
So this residency was based in Dunedin, and was that pivotal to basing the story there, especially in such a beloved site?
Yes, absolutely. When I found out that I had the residency, I was doing loads of research. But to have time to walk the streets, I really spent all my time just going to all the spots I was writing about. I mean, you can Google things and read things, but to be there, you just get the experience, don't you, which hopefully I can put in the book.
Did you have much of a connection with the city before this?
So I've got a lifelong love affair with Dunedin. My father was a Hallenstein store manager, and we used to go there as a family to the head office in Dunedin. So for me as a child, that was a really magical time. I'm married to a man from Dunedin, and he spent many years there. And so we visit a lot, and it really feels like a second home to me. I particularly love the Otago Peninsula, and of course that's where Lanark Castle is.
All right. The story like this, because how many books have you written now, Karen?
This is number 22.
Yeah. Fantastic. And so the story presumably doesn't, I finish this book, here's my next idea. Is it a case that all the stories are living?
They're percolating
kind of,
away.
Little doors waiting for the chance to come out.
That's such a good way to describe it. Yeah, like my brain's probably a bit strange, but I've got all these projects just percolating away. But I think when you do that, I mean, this is at least 10 years me thinking about it, but it means you're always kind of, you know, noticing things and reading things just with that in the background.
When did you first write?
Oh, I was 10 years old. I used to think every kid did this. I used to write these terrible short stories that were published in the Sunday News. And I used to...
You got them published?
Yeah, yeah. And I used
at
to
10?
I did. And
I won a library competition at 10 and I thought I had a brilliant future as a novelist. Not so.
I used to get these little coupons that you'd exchange at the post office for money and little certificates.
Yeah,
but I was terrible. I used to like write, you know, people I didn't like into the stories and had them all by lions in the desert, you know, things like that.
Dystopian fiction at that time. But you finished. I think that's an interesting thing because lots of kids will start things and finish with and then I woke up or they won't finish at all. But you wrote and finished. You were a natural writer from a very young age.
It's just something I absolutely love. And I think any creative person out there will understand that you just do it because you love it so much. Whether you're an artist or a musician, a writer, that's your driving force.
So to have the first novel published, when did that happen?
So that was 2003. But actually, that wasn't a novel, that was a non-fiction book. So about cancer, actually. Unfortunately, it's been a plague in my family.
I'm
my parents died young.
Yeah.
And I ended up, long story short, doing volunteer work for hospice. And I did a lot of interviews with people, but they sent me out to interview Mitch Albom one time. You know, very famous. We watched Tuesdays with Maury. And we started talking, and I told him just a little bit about my mum and dad. I think I was so nervous, he took pity on me, to be honest. And when I told him about my parents, he said, "Girl, you've got a book there." And because I had this famous person telling me he had a book, I actually kind of looked into it and I ended up writing this book called Unbreakable Spirit.
Are you one of those wonderful people who goes with people who are in palliative care and helps them write their story? Is that what you were doing?
No, more for their promotion for their newsletters and magazines.
I see. Yeah. And in that moment, though, in that connection, all these things that you have to connect as a writer, you had the inspiration and also the encouragement.
Definitely. And I think that all my books have always been inspired by people that I meet and real life events that springboard into all these amazing opportunities.
Which you take. I mean, just listening to your energy and your attitude, it's just let's do this kind of attitude.
Yeah.
So the first novel?
That was a novel called Watching Over Me, and it was published in the US.
Yeah, that rings a bell.
But probably people will more know the Paris of the East and the Paris of the West, which are historical novels.
Yes. Let's come to the new one. So the stories will just be what, little patchwork, little ideas, little settings or characters, and you carry them until it's time to write them, right?
Yeah.
And getting this time in Dunedin was what set you off on this. The challenge is, Lanark Castle is such a part of Dunedin history that you've got to have your own take on who's my character going to be, and especially if you're going back to the time of William Lanark being there.
Yes, yeah.
And his story. When did that thread, pardon the pun, present itself?
I love it. Yeah, very good. For me, it was very much my central character, Greer. So I was really drawn to the 1890s. It's such a progressive time in our history. Then reading, like, the laws that were passed are a cornerstone of our society now. They really are. And, of course, women got the vote in 1893. So I wanted to capture what it would have been like for a young woman in that era, just how exciting it would have been. You know, we can think about it quite academically, but this is a young woman on the ground. This is happening in her lifetime. So she's having opportunities that her mother's generation never would have had. So I really wanted to kind of capture that, if I could, in the book.
So what happens, we won't give spoilers for the story, but how does she come to be at Larnex Castle and at this time?
So we first meet her when she's travelling up on the buggy in the Otago Peninsula up to Larnex Castle. She's there to work as a servant because she's just been recently orphaned. You know, and she had all these great dreams, but her options are very limited at this point in her life. So I like to tell the readers, like, thankfully we don't leave it like that. But that was a nice way to interconnect her life with William Larnex and his family and his troubles later in life. This is not a book about him. It's definitely a book about Greer, but his story counterpoints hers just beautifully, you know, from a literary point of view.
So you put her close to this kind of centre of New Zealand history and Dunedin history. She's in the orbit, but the story remains about her.
Yes.
How do you put her in his orbit then and somehow connect to this very tragic family story and all the rumours that surrounded it? You know, he suicided, of course, famously, Larnex. But was it up to wife three, I think, and all the family stories. You want to have that in your book, but you don't want it to be the centre of the book.
No,
right?
It's like a glimpse into that. Mm. And it's very much Greer's story, but we get the glimpse of his life and his family life. But it is a glimpse. It's not an in-depth look at that.
So what do you want to do? What have you done with her as a character now, with this time of potential, but as an orphan and now off to work?
Well, she's got a love of music and she plays the violin. So this is her most precious possession. It's the family heirloom that's been handed down from her grandmother. So she wants to do something with that in life, which is probably going to be like playing it in the parlour, you know, hopefully with her husband one day down the track. But then, you know, that's a far off dream. She's by herself at this point at the beginning of the novel. And also she's a very good seamstress. And of course, this is back in the day before we had mass production of clothing. Like, being a seamstress actually can be a career for a woman. So I don't want to give anything away, but when she goes back to where she grew up, the Devil's Half Acre, she makes these connections with this beautiful Lebanese family that have taken over her old cottage where she was raised by her father. And because of her connections with that, these opportunities that come out that in life.
So we're beginning to get more of Dunedin's history and the various cultures that came to the city over time. She loves to play the violin. It's not a spoiler, at a pergola, which gives you this beautiful view down the peninsula.
Oh,
right?
Yes.
So you're able to bring the city's beauty in as a character as well. Tell me about wanting to bring in other characters of the time, other cultures of the time. The Suhoi family feature here, famous Dunedin family, of course. Do you sort of stumble across that in terms of your research, or does it... In going back to this part of the city, was it just obvious that these characters would become part of the story as well?
That's a great question. I think it's a mix. For me, I was very interested in exploring some of my own Irish-Scottish heritage. But when I discovered about the Devil's Half Acre, I thought, aha, I really want to write about this. You know, the Irish, Scots, Lebanese and Chinese all living together in this very poor but thriving community. And that really appealed to me. And of course, the Devil's Half Acre, that term comes from the gold rush days. You know, it was opium dens and it was a place of iniquity and sin, if you can say that.
But and when fun.
Yeah.
And characters, rich characters, right?
But when I went in the period that I'm writing about, it was really this thriving community. I love the fact of these immigrants just supporting each other and just...
So who called it that? Who dumped it there?
I don't know.
Okay.
You know, but it was so infamous that they actually changed Walker Street to Carroll Street in 1916. That's how bad it was.
We're not quite South Dunedin. We're on the hill. We're at the... less sort of wealthy end of the main hill, along from the Octagon, up sort of Manor Place, that kind of place.
Yes. And of course, these days it's more just cottages and stuff. It's not the little laneways that were there back in the day.
Yeah. So you go back here, and how do you bring the story of these other characters into the main story?
Well, I did set myself a bit of a challenge with this one, didn't I? But it just seemed, again, if I focus on Greer and her story, then it all comes together. So I think that's the way for any novice. If you've got the central character and you make it their story, then everything else goes with it. So I was able to, you know, put Charles Suhoi into it as a little cameo, you know, and that was lovely to do. And I actually spoke to his grandson, you know, to get a bit more information about him. And I just thought, what an extraordinary person to be able to, you know, just put a little cameo in my book.
Yeah. Well, you spoke to the family also. You mentioned Hallensteins. You spoke to family members here. Because this is the other thing. When you are writing, even in fiction, you are writing in historical characters, and ones that are only a couple of generations back. You do want to get it as right as you can. So what was involved there?
Yeah, I try to be really respectful with that. And of course, and they're not central characters, they're just cameos or in the background. But wherever I can, it's really, I mean, you can read as much as you can, but if you can talk to someone, that makes a huge difference.
And do people cooperate?
People were really, they were just very happy to help me, which is just extraordinary, really, isn't it?
The arc of Greer's life without giving things away. We mentioned your first books as a 10-year-old were dystopian fiction where people came to a terrible end. But when you're writing now, it's for whom? And it's with what kind of narrative arc, typically?
So I think one of my readers told me the other day that I write about love and loss and resilience, that they're the central themes that come through in my novels. And I thought, actually, I do. Like, kind of on a subconscious level, that's what I'm doing. I think Greer, of course, you know, I've lost my parents young, so I could channel that grief. And her character arc, I suppose she's a compilation of all these industrious women of the era that have come together to create her. So I think, again, I don't want to give too much away because, you know, there's a love story as well in this book.
Yes, there has to be, does there?
Yeah, but I think there does. And love's such an integral part of our lives, isn't it? So I mean, why would I leave that out? And especially in this era where it's quite normal for her to get married and hopefully have a family. So but will she choose the right partner? You know, that's the big question when you read this book.
Do you have an audience in mind when you write? As I said, we're up to number 22, so we're talking, a prolific career. And is there an audience that you have in mind because you know they will want the next one?
Yes, I do. And like my readers are always asking me when my next book's coming out. So I know my reader, and I write for myself, of course, as well. So this is shamelessly a book. You know, it's perfect for Mother's Day. It's a great book you can give to your mum or your nana. Like it's like a clean romance. So that's very much the way I write anyway. You know, so I think people, if they read my books, they usually come away that there's gritty things in there, but they come away feeling a bit uplifted.
There's huge demand for this genre, isn't there?
Yeah, and it's my favourite genre personally. I love historical fiction, you know, and I just love that you can just learn a little bit about something in a fun way. I enjoy that.
Do readers, how much contact do you have with them? Because this is another challenge always as well, the personalising of the relationship these days between, I don't know, rugby players, it's becoming increasingly in the audience. For you, has that always been natural, and how do you foster it and encourage it?
I think it's so easy these days because people email me all the time via my website. That's easy, but I do a lot of events. So, like, I just did an event the other day with 70 women and, like, just spent a lot of time chatting with them, and just, like, what a joy. That's, I think, probably one of my favourite things, apart from writing books because I love writing, is actually meeting my readers.
How have you refined your craft over time? Or has it simply been the act of writing?
I think because I've done it from such a young age, it's like a natural thing. But of course, I'm always honing it and trying to improve it and working with wonderful editors
and
publishers.
There was no course here or course there?
I've got a diploma of writing and an advanced diploma of applied arts. So yes, I have done the hard yards of, you know, getting into the grammar that's not my thing. You know, I'm a natural storyteller and I've always got structure. I always get the structure nailed. But I write like a maniac, so my first draft's like riddled with typos.
So you go fast, go hard, and then come back and fix things.
I do, but I don't want anyone to see my first draft because it's terrible. But, you know, that's my process. And I know some writers, they do perfect, you know, sentences at a time. That's not my process. So you just got to find what works for you.
Just grueling, sweating over changing a word in a sentence.
I don't do that. I like to have the joy of it.
What was the research required for this as well? We've talked about talking to the family, but also you've got to kind of get yourself into. One of the things I think that's underappreciated about Dunedin from those who don't know it is the architecture and how much of that historic architecture remains for now.
Yeah.
And it's a key part of the history and being able to touch the history.
Absolutely.
To actually walk in a suburb to see the Suvoy building. I think it's still there. I can remember as a kid with the sign, the big sign on it, for example. And, of course, Larnach Castle itself, just so central to the peninsula. But what other kind of research did you do to try and really put yourself in the time and place?
Lots of reading of books. And also, we've got a few newspapers, the Treasure Trove, and you can get online and read them too. So that was really helpful with William Larnach, because I could read the newspaper articles about everything. So, you know, you go to the source at the time. And I had my secret weapon, where I had my husband, who loves all things Victorian, lived like a Victorian for many years in Dunedin, so I could just suck information out of his mind into mine. So I really enjoyed that process.
For people who want to write but who don't think they'll be good enough, don't think they'll be able to get a book published, don't think they'll be able to sort of get there, I'm interested in what you would say to them about just getting on with it, and that, yes, there will be an audience for you, even if it's an audience of one. What would you say? Because this energy that you bring to it, this positivity that you bring to it, I think could be encouraging to a lot of people out there who are writing and thinking,
I honestly think if I can do it, anyone can do it, because there's nothing special about me. So I think if you just bring some joy and love to it and enjoy it, that's going to be the key thing. But obviously, read a lot. I don't know any published writer that's not a reader, so make sure you read.
So what do you read?
Oh, I read like 200 or 300 books a year. I read everything. So, but historical fiction is my favourite. But, you know, I read crime novels, I read non-fiction, I just read everything. It's a bit of a magpie.
So read, and then what?
And then write. You know, a lot of people spend a lot of time talking about it. Do it. You know, and I don't have, you know, a regular time that I write. You know, just try to squeeze it in when you can do it. You know, because people have got busy lives, they've got jobs, they've got families. But if you can, like, go, look, I won't watch TV for half an hour, I might just, you know, write, that's the way to start doing it.
The idea of drawing on your own life as well, and my condolences, when you lose your parents young, you're kind of forever that age in some ways, aren't you?
You are.
So you never really sort of say goodbye to that, I have to say. But to write what you know, was writing that first non-fiction book and you know, going places that you knew well, was that also an important start to all
I
this?
Think
it was important
so.
Personally, but important as a writer?
I think probably it's going to be a lot easier if you can be writing about something you know, because otherwise it's just going to add so many layers of research. And I think we've all read the books where people maybe don't know too much, they haven't done enough research, and it just doesn't ring true for the reader. So certainly, and often, like, the things you're passionate are going to come from your own life anyway, you know. So I think that's the key, isn't it? Like, what are you passionate about? You know, if you're going to write a book or a short story, even a poem, you know, what are you passionate about? Get that down.
Thank you for the energy. Thank you for the book. Turbulent Threads it is, the latest novel by Karen McMillan, published by
Quinton Wilson Publishing.
There you go. Thanks very much, Karen. Thanks for coming in.